Multiple Wisconsin municipalities and residents have filed lawsuits this month against companies they say are responsible for PFAS contamination in their water systems. Residents in the town of Stella in north central Wisconsin announced a suit against paper manufacturers and the 3M company. The city of Eau Claire announced a suit against various manufacturers of products containing PFAS chemicals. And earlier this summer, the town of Campbell on French Island filed a legal claim against the city of La Crosse that could also turn into a lawsuit. This local litigation comes as large corporations like DuPont and 3M are proposing settlements in federal suits over PFAS contamination. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has expressed his opposition to those settlements, saying they don't go far enough. Residents affected by PFAS pollution are left wondering what impact these suits could have when it comes to remediating current contamination and preventing future pollution. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these PFAS lawsuits in Wisconsin? Do you think lawsuits could help resolve some of the contamination issues? How should polluters be held accountable, if at all? Do you want to see regulation to prevent future pollution? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Tony Wilken-Gibbard is Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. Tony, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Why are we seeing this wave of suits over the, really, just the last few months here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think there are a few reasons for that. One reason, of course, is that PFAS are a significant concern in many communities across Wisconsin. They're spread throughout the environment. And more communities are realizing that they have significant PFAS contamination in their water supplies in particular. Another reason, I think, has to do with just the historical context of where we are in the process of confronting the significant environmental concern. PFAS are still largely considered emerging contaminants. And what that really means is not that they're emerging into the environment, but that our knowledge and our regulatory response to PFAS are still emerging. It's not until very, very recently that some of our main environmental laws have been updated to address PFAS, and we still have a long way to go. I think another kind of just important background consideration here is the way in which our country deals with toxic chemicals in general. We allow companies to put chemicals like PFAS into the environment with very minimal and ineffective oversight. And the burden is on the government to prove harm rather than the manufacturer to prove that the chemicals are safe. So we have a system that isn't proactive. And then when we discover that a chemical is cause for concern, like PFAS are, it takes many years for our environmental laws to catch up. And so in the absence of that regulation, one of the only ways that governments or individuals can get any kind of accountability from polluters is through civil tort actions. And the claims that we're talking about here are generally civil tort claims, and they're based on the idea that even if the use or the production of PFAS weren't directly prohibited or regulated at the time, which they weren't, the polluter, the defendant, knew or should have known that there was a significant risk here that PFAS could cause harm, and therefore they should be held responsible for compensating the people in the communities that have been harmed. So we're seeing so many of these kinds of lawsuits because right now at this stage of our response to PFAS, they really are one of the only avenues. And indeed, there is quite a bit of evidence to show that PFAS polluters knew for some time that the products that they were manufacturing posed significant health risks, and they withheld that information and continued to distribute them into the marketplace. And that's why there's quite a bit of power behind these lawsuits that we're now seeing.
And we've been talking in the past tense a little bit, but what is the current state of regulation when it comes to this class of chemicals in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's still evolving. Like I said, just last year, our state set a drinking water standard for PFAS. We set regulations for wastewater dischargers, to limit the amount of PFAS that's being sent into surface waters from places like wastewater treatment facilities. But we haven't yet to see some of the main environmental laws that we have on the federal level, like CERCLA, be updated to reflect the fact that PFAS is a hazardous substance. So when it comes to holding polluters accountable, again, these kinds of civil lawsuits are one of the only avenues that we have. We still don't have a groundwater standard for PFAS in Wisconsin, which is one thing that my organization, MEA, is working on with folks from the Marinette-Peshtigo area.
One more bit of background on these chemicals. If we talk about something like DDT, that, as I understand it, is one chemical. When we say PFAS, it's a group, a big group of different chemicals. Is that part of what's making it difficult to regulate these chemicals, that it's hard to do them as a whole category versus individual subsets of that category?
Yeah, exactly. So the general approach is to regulate individual compounds, specific compounds. And so far, we in Wisconsin, as far as drinking water, we've only regulated PFOA and PFOS, which are two of the most widely studied compounds. But we're talking about a class of hundreds of compounds. And that kind of piecemeal approach, where regulators generally don't have the power or choose not to regulate compounds or chemicals as a class, is again one of the reasons that the process of responding to these kinds of situations is so difficult. The other thing that I would say, and maybe we kind of just skipped over this, is as far as the extent of the PFAS problem, is that these compounds were manufactured and put into products for decades. Products like nonstick cookware, which folks may be aware of, firefighting foam, which is a huge concern throughout the state, also food packaging. So they were manufactured and distributed for decades. They don't break down easily in the environment, and so they're called forever chemicals for that reason. But because they are so ubiquitous in the environment, folks sometimes call them everywhere chemicals. So there is a huge challenge before us. As we've been talking about, these lawsuits are an appropriate initial step, but we have a long way to go.
Let's bring on a caller. Colette is with us in Eagle River. Colette, hi.
Hi, I was wondering about milk organite. If that is tested for PFAS, being it comes from the Milwaukee sewage system and is distributed all statewide through at least Menard.
Colette, thanks for the call. Now, this was in the news a couple years ago. A study found, claimed to find some PFAS chemicals in this particular brand of fertilizer. The company said there weren't significant amounts in there. Is this something that you've been tracking, Tony?
Well, that's one of the reasons why it's important to have surface water standards in place so that the state has the ability to regulate what the products that the byproducts of wastewater treatment, including milorganite, but also including the effluent that goes into surface water. I'm generally aware that there is some level of concern about milorganite, and one of the, kind of more generally a concern here is the sludge that has been spread on fields throughout Wisconsin, biosolids, which are similar to milorganite, a byproduct of wastewater treatment that's used as fertilizer. And that's one of the main concerns in the town of Stella and the subject of their lawsuit, that a paper mill that was treating wastewater knew that, or should have known, that there was PFAS included in that sludge that was used as fertilizer in and around their community.
Colette, thanks for that call. We're talking to Midwest Environmental Advocates Executive Director Tony Wilkin-Gibbard about lawsuits over PFAS contamination in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad to see Wisconsin residents, in some cases municipalities, suing manufacturers or other sources of these pollutants? How big of an impact do you think these lawsuits could have? Is this a problem in your community, in your local water? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Tony Wilkin-Gibbard. He's the Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. He's with us today to look at the impact that lawsuits could have on PFAS contamination here in Wisconsin, the class of so-called forever chemicals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about lawsuits over contamination with this class of chemicals, about regulation, what it is, what it isn't? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Ernest is with us in Hayward. Ernest, hi.
Hi. You know, toxic chemicals that we know are toxic should be immediately taxed. You know, you can't ban every chemical, but you can tax something that's toxic. And when you tax something, you have less of it. And new chemicals that are being introduced into the environment should be constantly surveilled. And when it becomes obvious that it is toxic, we should shift taxes onto these toxic chemicals. It's a very simple way to allow the market to function.
Ernest, thanks for the call. Tony, is this a strategy you've seen of not outright banning a particular substance, but taxing it to limit its use, as Ernest hopes?
Well, you know, historically there were taxes on industries that have caused contamination to fund Superfund and other remediation programs. So that has been a strategy that's been used. I definitely agree with the caller that we need more resources to provide proper oversight. And that's one of the problems that we have, is that it's impossible for the EPA to keep up with the number of compounds that are being introduced into the environment on an annual basis. There is just not enough funding and capacity to go around to do any kind of reasonable risk assessment. And as we talked about earlier, the way the system is set up is that the burden is on the government to show that something is harmful, and that can be a very intensive process, rather than on the producer to show that their chemical is safe. And that, I mean, that would be another way to just ensure that the cost of safety is borne by the producer or the manufacturer, if they were responsible for conducting the tests and showing that a product is safe before they put it out in the environment. So it might have, in some ways, a similar function as a tax, like the caller suggests.
Thanks for that call, Ernest. And Tony, Ernest mentioned surveillance, trying to find these chemicals. I understand there's some controversy over that in Wisconsin. The state DNR wants to be able to monitor potential polluters for PFAS emissions. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and other business groups say no, they don't have the authority to do that. What's the view on that from where you're sitting?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lawsuit filed, I believe, in 2022, last year, by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce to limit DNR's testing authority of wastewater dischargers. So there was, WMC filed a lawsuit about that testing. Events have kind of overtaken that controversy, thankfully, because we now have clear legal authority for DNR to conduct that testing and that surveillance, because we have that surface water quality standard for PFOA and PFOS on the books. The authority existed prior to that, as the Jefferson County Court found in that lawsuit and sided with the state. But we kind of have a belt and suspenders situation now, because thankfully the law has developed in the interim. Another lawsuit that is really critical here is WMC's lawsuit, again, against the Department of Natural Resources over its response to PFAS. But this lawsuit is over the spills law. And the spills law is the main protection that we have in the state of Wisconsin against all toxic spills. And WMC is alleging that the state illegally considers PFAS compounds to be hazardous substances under the spills law. They claim that the state must go through a complicated rulemaking process to define PFAS compounds as hazardous before PFAS polluters are responsible for reporting those discharges and investigating them and cleaning them up. And that is a pending matter that is before the Wisconsin Court of Appeals that will have huge significance for how our state is able to respond to these matters and hold polluters accountable. It is a more efficient way of ensuring that there is accountability than these piecemeal lawsuits that have to be brought by individual municipalities or even individual homeowners and families, it's important that there be a statewide regulatory response to hold polluters accountable. And that's exactly what the spills law is, but it is under threat in this litigation. So we see all kinds of lawsuits. We see civil suits against polluters, and then we see industry groups that represent polluters that are trying to slow and weaken the process of a governmental or a state response to PFAS.
Let's bring things around to our starting point, Tony. Those civil lawsuits filed by communities or individual residents, often against companies that they allege are responsible for PFAS contamination. What is the bar they have to meet to establish that, yes, in fact, these companies are responsible and they have to pay for it?
Well, there are hundreds of lawsuits, they all have different claims and different facts. So I can't speak to the particularities of of that. But I would say, as a general matter, we're talking about tort claims against responsible parties like PFAS manufacturers or companies that knowingly distributed PFAS. And so there, the real nub of all those claims boil down to that the company knew or should have known that it was creating a risk by distributing PFAS into the environment and profiting from the sale of PFAS-containing products. And, like we talked about, DuPont, just as an example, had known for decades that there was ample reason to be concerned about very, very serious health effects of the PFAS compounds that it was manufacturing and putting into commerce, because even some of its own workers were experiencing very, very serious health effects. That, in 2001, there was a class action lawsuit in West Virginia, which is the subject of the movie Dark Waters. And there was ample evidence in that class action lawsuit about DuPont's knowledge. So it really comes down to, in these civil cases, the knowledge of the responsible party about the risk that they were creating to the people who have been harmed.
Thanks to our guest, Tony Wilkin-Gibbard, Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. He joined us to talk about lawsuits over PFAS contamination in Wisconsin, what they can mean for regulations, along with solutions to current contamination problems and prevention of future pollution. Now, the city of Milwaukee has organizations, ordinances, and policies aimed at trying to protect residents from lead poisoning. But as Wisconsin Watch reporter Farah Anderson reports, the city often fails to hold landlords accountable for lead hazards that are poisoning tenants and their families.
Milwaukee resident Denise Honegger is sitting on the porch of a house off Locust Street in North Milwaukee. It's her first house that's been lead-free in 6 years.
There is not one speck of lead in my house now. I'm so happy. I got tears in my eyes. I'm so happy.
She moved into a house in 2017 that had lead, and then another, and another, and another. Her daughter and grandchild were both hospitalized from lead poisoning, and each time they moved, they thought they were safe. But when their landlords refused to address the lead in each property, they left.
We were homeless and in a hotel for a year at a time. I paid out my pocket. Nobody was helping us. We lost everything in each house.
Almost 5% of Milwaukee children under 6 tested in 2021 had blood lead levels above 5 micrograms per deciliter. More than half of the city's residents are renters, and lead poisoning rates are highest in neighborhoods where more people rent. Last year, the city's Common Council created more penalties for landlords who don't comply with government orders to fix lead hazards by removing lead paint or dust. But from July 2022 to June 2023, the city's health department issued just 26 lead-related citations to city landlords. And a Wisconsin Watch review of city records showed 9 of those citations were dropped because of out-of-date inspections. Michael Mannon is director of home environmental health for the city. He says many landlords fail to comply with lead abatement orders.
And the problem here is that it's a lack of willingness and engagement on the landlord's part to do their duty, because they're the ones collecting rent. They have to maintain the property.
The Common Council also tried to protect renters from retaliation if they complained about lead. But often, renters are too scared to report or don't know how to complain. And if they move out because of lead, landlords can sue for rent collection. That's what happened to Deanna Branch. Her son Aiden was hospitalized twice for severe lead poisoning from old paint in a Milwaukee rental property. Child Protective Services told her Aiden couldn't be discharged if she couldn't provide a safe home. She left the house and moved in with family that same day.
Instead of depressed and angry, I should have been upset that they were like literally trying to blame me for just trying to provide a house for my son. I didn't think about it like that at the time. I thought about like, oh my God, like I'm gonna lose my kids. I'm a terrible mother.
For the city to order lead remediation, a child has to test at 15 micrograms per deciliter. That's 4 times higher than what the CDC calls a concerning lead level. At that point, the city will cover the cost of abatement. Brittany Shanick is a lawyer with Legal Action of Wisconsin. She represents clients in tenant-landlord lawsuits involving lead.
There's nothing to incentivize a landlord from doing that lead abatement up front, you know, out of their own bottom line.
Since 2011, the state of Wisconsin has passed several statutes making it difficult for cities to set up proactive rental inspections, which could catch lead hazards before tenants move in. Some municipalities like Eau Claire and Racine have still created rental inspection programs. Heiner Giese is a lawyer who represents landlords in the Rental Property Association of Wisconsin. Giese says Milwaukee could use similar programs to protect kids from lead.
The city just says it doesn't have the money to do those. That's the real problem, but they can't do them.
Deanna Branch is now in a lead-free home. She formed the Coalition on Lead Emergency in 2018 to make sure other parents don't have to experience what she did.
So I just felt like as a mother, I was definitely failing him because I didn't know the answer. And as a parent, you want to know the solution. You want to know how to best help your child.
The Milwaukee Health Department says they'll be ramping up enforcement against landlords this fall. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Farrah Anderson.
For more information about Wisconsin Watch's investigation into lead hazards in Milwaukee rental properties, visit wisconsinwatch.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a consumer technology expert helps us figure out what to do with all those old photos and documents, collecting dust in the attic or taking up space on our phone or our computer. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about watching chimney swifts at dusk.
We all have a lot of things to cross off our to-do list. Have you taken out the trash? Are the bills paid? Laundry folded? And if you're writer Catherine Jago, have you paused and turned your gaze skyward at dusk to witness the dance of the chimney swifts?
On August 31st, I hear that the chimney swifts are roosting in the brick chimney at Our Lady Queen of Peace Church. At summer's end, swifts mass in great flocks at dusk as they prepare to migrate south. My husband and I resolved to go there after dinner. It isn't an auspicious evening, cloudy and spitting with rain. We're bickering as we get into the car, anxious we'll be late. We arrive at 7:10, and I scurry ahead, clutching my binoculars, in search of the right chimney. I see nothing in the sky. We come to an expansive parking lot at the back of the church. Some minivans have pulled up, and people are sitting next to them on lawn chairs, chatting companionably. Two women are lying face up in an empty paddling pool. There are kids of various ages tooling around on the blacktop on bicycles and scooters, impervious to the drizzle. We join a small knot of birders gathered around an elderly gentleman in a wheelchair, wearing a tweed hat with a plaid woolen blanket tucked around his knees. I see only two swifts, tiny and high up. They look like cigars on wings, with the same rapid fluttering as bats or scraps of burned paper. But as the minutes pass, they multiply as if conjured out of the air. Now I can hear their high, sweet chittering. For a while, they swirl around in all directions, but gradually they cohere into loose ovals, the skein bulging this way, then that, above the rooftops. The old man is as excited as a boy. "Mother and I never saw this many," he exclaims, pointing skyward with a tremulous forefinger, his enthusiasm infectious. "Another first. Pretty good for a 91-year-old, his daughter says, affectionately. I keep checking my watch. Our necks begin to ache, gazing up. Sunset is at 7:34, although tonight it's only a glow in the dense cloud. As 7:30 approaches, the chimney seems to exert a magnetic attraction. Individual swifts dive towards it. Most pull out of the turn and veer off, but the odd one vanishes. At 1 minute before sunset, the flock's loose swirling picks up energy, like water circling around a drain, and suddenly they're pouring themselves down the chimney as if down a funnel and vanishing. I imagine the commotion inside the chimney, hundreds of small birds jockeying for a perch on the masonry with their tiny claws. I wonder if they prefer certain spots, higher up or lower down, and how they all get into such a tight space without colliding or hurting one another. When all of them are gone, there is soft applause. Someone says, "Sleep well, guys." I stand leaning into my husband, who has his arms around me from behind. When I turn around, people are dotted all over the parking lot in twos and threes, staring up, smiling. They have appeared out of nowhere, like the swifts. It wasn't a spectacular sunset, or a spectacular number of birds, 300 or 400 at most. But there's a collective sense of peace and pleasure. I resolve to come back at dusk, whenever I can, before they leave.
Catherine Jago is a translator and writer whose most recent poetry collections are Bloodroot and News from the North. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, I mentioned on the show last week that I had recently digitized some old slides for a relative, and this got me thinking about all the other pictures laying around. That big tote full of, you know, printed off film pictures, files and files of photos and videos on a computer, that old camera with a tape. I don't know what to do with that. I'm probably not the only one, I reckoned, who looks at those boxes of photos and memorabilia and feels overwhelmed at the prospect of sorting and digitizing everything. Not just analog stuff like photos and documents. How about home videos recorded on older formats like VHS, Betamax, Super 8? Not to mention, once we've done all the legwork of scanning and uploading, what are the best ways to organize and protect the files for the future? Our next guest has been answering questions like this for over 25 years, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you organize and preserve your own photos and videos? Do you have questions for our guest about digitizing photos, videos, maybe even documents? Maybe you're a seasoned pro and you have solutions to share with us. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. J.D. Beersdorfer has been writing about consumer technology for the New York Times since 1998. She's the author or co-author of 8 books on consumer technology topics and co-hosts the podcast Pop Tech Jam. J.D., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here.
I understand, J.D., you've been working on your own family archives lately. Help me. How did you start?
First of all, you really just have to go through all the boxes. I've recently inherited a family archive of stuff and we're finding all kinds of things, including tintypes, I think, from the late 19th century. But before you get started, I think it's very important to go through all of the boxes, all of the slide carousels, all of the photo albums, see what you've got, take an inventory, and then figure out what's really worth digitizing and maybe what was not really a good shot even back then that you don't need to save. And then once you have all of this stuff and figure out how many formats and things you're dealing with, then sort of make a plan about how you want to go about doing your digitization work. And I think I mispronounced that. It's a long afternoon here on Eastern time.
It works for me. Now, JD, I want to dig into something you mentioned there. I've got all these photos, some in print, some, you know, zillions of pictures of my kids when they were precious little babies. In one mood, I'll destroy lots of stuff. In another, I'm like, I can't imagine getting rid of everything. How do we get in the right lane in determining how much we want to keep and how we set our priorities for what we want to save in the first place?
Well, I think you go. I mean, obviously, there's always the top tier photos that everyone remembers passing around. You know, clearly those are the winners that you want to keep. If there are old family members that you know, a lot of people don't remember, maybe you want to have some reference point for them. When I was going through my own mother's archive, I was finding a lot of photos of people we had no idea who they were. We weren't related to them, and then also. And my grandfather was a big fan of the Ektachrome slides in the mid-century America. And so he would always take slides. And so we've got tons and tons of carousels. But he would also buy slides in the store. And so I would be going through his carousels, figuring out which ones I wanted to convert. And I would see all these store-bought ones of like Mount Rushmore. I was like, well, I don't really need to keep that. So I think, you know, you want to get the ones that are deeply personal to you and that just really evoke a strong memory, or they're people that are gone from your life that you want to have this record of them, and start there and then kind of work your way down. Obviously, I think every family's probably got some duds in the batch that you can just sort of push aside, and those will be pretty obvious. You know, here's the picture of Dad's thumb, you know, when he misfired the camera.
The photos are the duds, not the family members.
Yeah. The photos would be the duds. And there's some, too, like when you're going through and you see some prints that are maybe damaged because they've been stored improperly or they're cracked and they're scratched. Don't throw those out immediately because thanks to the miracle of software, you can also repair those digitally once you get them scanned. So even if it looks like it's a hopeless case, there's things you can do in photo editing programs that can really revive your photos.
Let's talk about some of the how-to here. And let's start with those slides you mentioned. And that was my starting point here. I'm fortunate my parents are more tech-savvy than I am. I borrowed a slide converter that you can plug into your computer. What's out there for either technology we can use at home or you know, are there services we can go to if we don't want to screw around with doing it ourselves?
Yeah, the answer is a yes to both. You mentioned that your parents had a slide scanner. Clearly, they were not messing around with their slides. And if you have a ton that you want to personally scan, investing in the hardware like a dedicated slide scanner that hooks into your computer is a good way to do it. It's time consuming because you're sort of going through. you can go one by one. Sometimes you can gang them up depending on the model. If you've just got a handful of slides and you want to play around, there's actually smartphone apps that you can do that will capture transparency, either film negative or slides. It can be a little hinky just with the getting it to focus right. But if you just got a handful and you just really want to get these few photos, it's a low-cost investment to capture. That way, Kodak makes a little box thing that opens up and you can put film and slides in that and put your smartphone on top and capture the film that way. It illuminates it from the bottom, because that's the thing, as you know, with transparencies, you have to illuminate them from the back so that you can see the image, since that would be normally how you would view them. If it was a slide, you'd have the slide projector with the light blasting through. You can make your own slide carry. If you have a traditional flatbed scanner, there are slide attachments you can get. I think Make Magazine did a little how-to hack where you can get some silver paper and sort of make the backing thing that illuminates it. It's a lot of work. So if you've got, say, 75 carousels full of slides that you're sort of looking at, first of all, go through and sort those. What I did when I was faced with over 300, I think, you know, I'm going to send these out. It's about 20 cents a slide, depending on where you send it, but there's some good services: scanmyphotos.com, DigMyPics, Memories Renewed, which I believe is right over next door in Minnesota, does a ton of all kinds of analog conversions, and they will give you a price on per slide. But what a lot of them will do is you send off your slides, they get them, they log them. Some services will let you decide which ones you want to keep. They'll scan them all, and then you'll see the preview, and then you see the duds in there, and you can choose not to have them saved. But what you get with a service is they're professionals, they're used to doing this, they have the equipment, and they also scan everything at a high enough resolution that you can make really nice prints from these slides. Because as you know, the actual image on a slide is 1.5 by 1 inch away. So you have to scan at a really high resolution to get that to be any bigger. And having a service that just does this for their business, you know, they will just crank it through. You know, it may take a few weeks for you to get your stuff back. And you do have to trust sending your media to this company, but usually they FedEx it back and forth, and I did not have a problem when I had it done. And it was not all that expensive when I factored in what it would cost me to buy the equipment to do it, what the time factor would be, the sort of hit or miss frustration factor until you found exactly the settings you wanted to use. I said, you know, I'm going to send these out and help the local economy there.
Talking to J.D. Beersdorfer, consumer technology columnist at the New York Times, finding out how to scan, preserve, and organize our old photos, videos, documents, and more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you do with old family photos, personal photos? Have you had a project in the last year or so going through stuff, deciding what to keep, what to get rid of, what to scan, how to save it? Do you have questions about how to do any or all of the above? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with New York Times consumer technology columnist J.D. Beersdorfer, talking about creating and maintaining a personal digital archive, what to do with all those old photos, whether printed off or on our computer, videos, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you doing something like that now? Have you found solutions on what to save, how to save it? Do you have questions about how to do it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. JD, let's go to the storage side of things now. You know, I have gigabytes, I think, of photos and videos. I'll have more if I scan that tote full of photos and whatnot. I keep old hard drives around as a backup. I'd like to get rid of them. What are the best storage methods out there right now?
A lot of people are fans of the cloud, you know, the ubiquitous cloud up there. And online storage has gotten a lot less expensive over the years. And Google and Apple or Dropbox, whoever, will be happy to sell you more space. You know, for a few dollars a month, if it's something that you think you want to do. I usually do an online storage and I'll do a local storage. But with online, if something happens to your house or whatever, you have all of your precious memories are stored up there in a cloud on somebody else's server far away. So that's something I always keep in the back of my mind, even though it may cost, you know, a few bucks a month. It's worth it for that peace of mind. I also do keep hard drives. Like yourself, I have some of the very small, compact, basic hard drives. But the thing with storage media, as we discovered also from back in the days of videotapes, legacy formats tend to go away after a while. And it's if you had a bunch of photos stored on a zip drive, you know, they don't make those anymore. Mm-hmm. So you really have to be careful when you're deciding how you're going to store these things. A lot of people will do archival CDs and just keep a CD player or a DVD player around for that purpose. But then you also have to worry, well, are the computer makers going to be able to accept, you know, attaching a CD player to a computer 10 years from now? So it is kind of worrisome, which is why I tend to just keep it in a digital format of some type and then keep it on either a solid state drive, a hard drive, the cloud again, and make sure it's a trustworthy company too, that you have security options in case you do have anything personal there. You want to be able to lock down your stuff and make sure the company's not going to go out of business and take all of your files with it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Philomena is with us in Viroqua. Philomena, hi.
Hi. So my question is more around editing. I have old 16 millimeter film that was converted to DVD. However, a lot of those films were not in the, you know, some of the scenes are real hard to see or they're dark or whatever. Do you have any suggestions about free, and I want to stress the word free, applications that could be used for editing video?
Oh, interesting question. What do you got?
Free is always a, I mean, there's a lot of open source software. If you are technically inclined, I'm going to go looking. People have probably made some video applications. When I've had to digitize and edit film or stuff that's been converted to film, I've used QuickTime on the Mac before, which usually comes, there's usually a version of QuickTime with the software. The old iMovie program, you can pull stuff in and do some editing there if your Windows. I have not done a lot of Windows lately, but I think there are probably some applications that Microsoft has made. But it can be very, you know, it's there's such huge files too. And I think iMovie will let you do clearly like trimming, you know, the bad stuff out of the clip if it's something, you know, you got a dead spot in the middle of nothing happened and then you just really want to have the highlights. It'll let you trim stuff. And but before you do, you know, just make sure you keep a backup of the film in case you do edit wrongly. I would just browse your local software archives and see, because a lot of people will, software developers are very generous sometimes and they want to share their skills. So much like people who can't afford Adobe Photoshop will find the software GIMP that works for Linux, and it's also multi-platform. You can do pretty much everything you do in Photoshop with that, and it's free because it's open source. So there are probably some video editors out there. If you're looking for audio, Audacity is a great audio editor as well.
Thanks, Philomena. Good luck. Hope that helps. Joyce joins us now in Shatek. Joyce, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Joyce.
Thank you. Yes, hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I was wondering about, I have some negatives. My grandpa was a photographer in the early 1900s, and I have some negatives that are like probably 18 to 20 inches long, and they're rolled up because they're more than 100 years old. And so I'm wondering, I would like to get them developed because they're history for our area here in Barron County. And I was wondering, what should I do? I've called around to museums, and, you know, there's no help out. Nobody develops negatives very much anymore.
Joyce, interesting. Any advice, JD?
Yeah, so this is undeveloped film that has been, the pictures have been shot, but it just hasn't been developed, or it's negatives that you just need to have prints made from the negatives on the roll.
Now, do you know which it is, Joyce? Are they undeveloped, or you just need some?
No, no. If you roll them out, they're negatives. You can see people and figures in barns and houses.
Okay, so they're film negatives. It may takes a little bit of research, but I might say if Memories Renewed over there in the Twin Cities might do pretty much everything I've thought of that you would want to convert. It's an older format, so they may have to get more information about it if it's not, just like a 35mm, which is a standard. Or see if there are any local photographers or photography schools that may have older equipment that could handle making prints from these. You mentioned historical societies, but maybe if you go more to an educational environment where they're teaching photography and have some of the old historical stuff, they might be able to help you out. If not, I would go to just call around to a film digitization service and see if, people who would normally just make prints from regular negatives, if they could handle this particular format that you have from your grandfather's cameras.
Joyce, good luck. Sounds like a great resource. JD, I'm in a position where I'm just like overwhelmed by the task, the big tote full of old photos. Can you leave us a little pep talk on tackling this and knowing that we can actually get something done?
Just psych yourself up. What I like to do, if I have a, if it's small stuff, there's a couple of phone scanning apps that I use. So like, if you thought I'm going to be training my computer all day, I'm going to be stuck with a scanner. There's a lot of great mobile scanning apps, Adobe Scan, that you can, and Google's Photo Scan too, which is great because it will automatically stitch together like curled prints and glare on photos and stuff and clean them up and make them nice. So I'll just put a stack, have a nice area, clean area, work area, put on some music, just sit there, and whether I'm using the phone or whether I'm flatbedding, just kind of rock out, you know, listen to a podcast, listen to some music, just kind of get into the groove. And before you know, you'll have, you know, 10 or 15 of these things scanned. Once you get the scans on your computer, you can show them off to friends, clean them up, you know, make them look real nice. I think that might inspire you to go on because you're capturing this history. You're putting it in a new format. You can share it with friends and family who never would have had a copy of this photo before. And you can be proud of yourself for that.
JD, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's JD Beersdorfer with the New York Times giving us advice on storing, digitizing, scanning our family photos and videos. Tomorrow on Central Time, a pair of country music songs have gone viral, gotten divided responses over their apparent political messages. We'll look at politics in country music tomorrow on Central Time.